Namacharya Shwadriya Thakur ki, Rem Zikho Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Adwaita Gadadha Shri Vasudi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki, Shri Shri Radha Krishna Gopa Gopina Chamakun Radha Kunigini Gopuran ki, Shri Vindavana Maturudam ki, Shri Navadip Mayapuram ki, Shri Jagannath Puridam ki, Ganga Mayi Jamunamayi ki, Bhakti Devi Tulsa Devi ki, Shri Guru Prampara ki, Shri Divine Grace Shri Bhakti Vrinda Shami, Shri Shila Prabhupada ki, Srimad Bhagavat Mahapurana ki, Samaveta Bhaktivinda ki, Gaur Premanandi Hari Hari Bol, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to the assembled devotees, all glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga Gaurista Srila Prabhupada. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauravani Vichani Nivishesh Shunyavari Prashachvistani. Yeah, well, what else are we going to do? I don't know where you left off, though.
We're on page 4. Bhishma Dev breathes his last. After the great sages and the Pandavas depart, Yudhishthir begins ruling the kingdom according to the instructions he has received from Bhishma Dev. 43 to 49 verses. Note, Bhishma left his body with his mind fixed upon the form of Lord Partha Sarathi, attaining Nirvikalpa Samadhi, 43 purport, in Vaikuntha Dham, 44 purport. It might appear to the reader that Bhishma's devotion to the Lord was tinged with jnana or salvationism. Yet in chapter 18 of Bhagavat Arkamrichi Mala, Srila Bhakti Vinod Thakur counts the sentiments he expresses in verses 33 and 41 to 42 as Siddha Prema Rasa. Perfectional love of God. Yes, in facing death, Bhishma resorted to traditional yogic method of meditation. Even the object of his meditation was the Narayan form of the personality of Godhead. But in the final analysis, these efforts were motivated by a heartfelt desire to attain the loving association of the personality of Godhead. In the Gita, we see that in the sixth chapter, then Krishna is giving the process of Dhyana Yoga. And of that, the last two are part of bhakti, the jnana and samadhi. So those are there. The other six, though they are also part of bhakti, the detail or the methodology in bhakti will be different. The principles are the same. You have rules to follow, those you should do, not do. You have proper ways that you should, you know, sit, stand, behave, and act and all that. You have the controlling that the energy that you have is always used in the Lord's service. You pull in the senses from the sense objects. You focus it on Krishna. Krishna becomes the point of your meditation and you become fully absorbed. So that's the same. So the last two are specifically. So he gives the karma aspect. The first six are considered as karma yoga in the yoga system. So you have karma yoga, the first six, and then the Dhyana Yoga. So you have what? Yoga Rurukshu and Yoga Rudha. Mm-hmm. Like this. So it's divided like that. So instead of that karma, we follow what's given in the Pancharatra and the Vedic, other, how you say, in the Vedic cultural aspects for the karma aspect. And then Gyan, then we have knowledge of the process, and then Dhyan is the meditations on Krishna. Therefore Krishna says, perform your activity, karma, in knowledge, jnana, thinking of me, that's jnana, for my satisfaction, that's bhakti. So throughout the Gita, Krishna is constantly mentioning that these four are put together. Then that's Buddha Yoga. So it's not a strange thing then, as Maharaj points out, that he did use the yoga system, but Krishna's giving it also in the Gita, the last two. When you come to the liberated stage, then dhyana is the natural position. Raghunath Das in his Manasiksha, he opens the invocation with prayers respecting the residents of Vrindavan, both who are physically present and those who are present there by meditation. Because in Bhava Bhakti, if one is embodied, one goes to the spiritual pastimes through meditation. One is actually there in the pastime in your spiritual form. But you're there by meditation from here. So it's commonly used.
You know, it's a standard process. But it may seem, as Maharaj points out, it may seem a bit unique, you know, in that it seems more like yoga. But then these formalizations, especially the Vaikuntha rasa, is very natural. You know, varnashram, meditate, these things are very common amongst the Vaikunthavasis like that. It's standard.
And Bhishma Dev is a participant in the direct lila of the Lord. We can see in his prayers in the Bhagavatam, and of course the other aspects of his relationship with Krishna are revealed in other places, Mahabharata. So he's actually a pure devotee of the Lord. I mean, otherwise how could he be privileged to participate with Krishna in his earthly lila, bhauma lila, and hold such a unique and outstanding position in that lila? And we see how because he's in that martial Kshatriya spirit, as a way of evoking a response from his beloved Krishna, because like Maharaj said, all this formality is going on, so he especially one day during the battle made a very intense attack upon Arjuna just to force Krishna to break his promise that I'll stay out of it, I'll just drive the chariot, but I won't get personally involved in the contest of arms. But because of Krishna's love for Arjuna, and Bhishma Dev forced that love out, and that satisfied. You really see, it's remarkable, you know.
Yeah, he did it taste the rasa of Krishna protecting his devotee.
Yes.
Breaking his own promise.
He was appreciating Krishna's relationship with Arjuna, but deriving so much satisfaction. That's a real Vaishnava, you see. Vaishnava appreciates, like Prabhupada writes in Nectar Devotion, Vaishnava thinks in himself, I'm not a devotee, I'm the most fallen, but he appreciates the devotional service of other Vaishnavas. I think there's Prabhupada, I think he has, isn't there, he shows us into looks, has us have a look into the thoughts of, I think it's Maharaj Yudhisthira, I remember correctly, who's thinking, what kind of devotee am I? Plod Maharaj, he was a real devotee of the Lord. That's the mood of the...
We see in Brihad Bhagavatam, each devotee Narad goes to, they say, oh, I'm not a devotee.
Yeah.
Hanuman's saying, I'm not a devotee, come on. Ram left me, he went to the city, I'm sitting out in the forest. He didn't, you know, each one is saying that actually has more love for someone else.
So, what is that? Vaishnavana? Prabhupada quotes Vaishnavana Vigneya. Now, Budchoy, what is it? I forgot my phrase. Kriya Mudra. Vigneya Budchoy. You cannot understand the mind of a Vaishnava. So we cannot. Bhishma may have used these. Because also, the Leela, even Krishna's, especially at Dwarka, when he took the role of a king, then he was setting an example. Rising early in the morning. He doesn't have to do any of this. He would meditate on himself. But he doesn't have to do that. He's under no obligation to do these things.
He's the only one that can feel himself one with the Supreme.
Yeah. He can practice the Mayavadi process. Nobody else can. And so also the leading devotees in the Lord's Leela, they also have that should be seen in their, what they're doing, that they're also setting an example. So Raja Yoga, there's a type of yoga that the Kshatriyas performed, and actually all the, you know, today there's so much fascination with the martial arts, the use of what the Chinese called qi, or the Japanese called ki, which means prana. So this is actually coming from the Kshatriya Raj Yoga, because pranayama, the first four stages, asan, yamyama asan, pranayama. And then pranayama part, they would engage the pranas in their martial practice. And that's through prana, because prana is the background of everything. Prana is in the Vedanta Sutra and Upanishads. Prana is often pointed to be the force that's moving everything in the universe. It's actually the breath of the universe. And we see that's how Dhruva Maharaj could. He was a Kshatriya. He was using that form of yoga, and he became so powerful that he could plug. He sort of plugged up the breathing of the universal form, and all the demigods, they ran to the Lord. You have to do something. He's become too powerful. We don't know how to deal with this. So that's how the Kshatriyas would have these amazing powers. Fire an arrow, and it would be like a guided missile, because they would be guiding it by their mental and pranic force. Wherever the enemy might run, the arrow would follow until it struck them. See, or they even more amazing is when they're actually using these daivi astras, these weapons from higher planets. One had to have very, very great power in order to be able to invoke them and control them, because they're the weapons of the demigods, not of human beings. So, Dr. Vinod, we were talking yesterday. Were we talking? Or no, I was talking with someone yesterday, how Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes that because when we see Maharaj Parikshit cursed near the end of the first canto, and Prabhupada commenting on this said that his father lamented that now the Brahmins will be remembered and blamed for having let the Kali Yuga enter. And actually, more or less, that's what happened. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur, in one of his writings, pointed out that the Kshatriyas, early in Kali Yuga, they got tired of their, you know, ritualistic brahmanas who were just arguing, debating over different esoteric points of Karmakanda and Sankhya Yoga and all these things. So, born into the Kshatriya class, or descended into the Kshatriya class, came Lord Buddha. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur presents Lord Buddha in this way as a kind of rallying point of a Kshatriya rebellion against the degraded Varnashram Dharma of his time. Buddha, of course, his mission was to teach the Ahimsa, because the Kshatriyas, in particular the Kshatriyas, were officiating over the animal sacrifices, because those animal sacrifices, they take away the sins of the kingdom. Because in any kingdom, there's always going to be the people who are sinful. And the sins come upon the king. So, since you even find this in the Bible. I was talking with Murari Gupta, that term scapegoat. You all know the term scapegoat? You've heard that? So that's described in the Bible, the Old Testament. A goat would be chosen, and all the sins of the people would be put inside the goat, and then the goat would be sacrificed. And so for that year, then the sins would be expiated. Of course, the sins just go somewhere else and wait. That's how the law of karma works. It doesn't really, you know, free you of sins. The kingdom as an entity is spared the sinful reactions for another year. So as long as they can perform all these rituals, the shraddha, the ceremonies and the sacrifices, then for their time on earth, they can live a life. But like Narada Muni, when he showed King Prachinibarhi, he said, look in the sky and see all the animals you've sacrificed. They're just waiting for you to leave your body. And then they're going to come and pierce you with their horns and stamp on you with their hooves. So the reaction they get later on. So anyway, because of the degradation of the Brahmin class, the animal sacrifice had degraded into mere slaughter. So Lord Buddha appeared in the Kshatriya class as a prince, because he knew the Kshatriyas would listen to me, and they actually had the power. By that time, the Kshatriyas, you see it also in European history, where the priests, the early priests of Christianity, they were the most powerful persons in early European, Western European society. Then there was a time when the Holy Roman Emperor and the kings became more powerful even than the priests, and they were deposing popes and putting in their own popes. And then the mercantile class became more powerful than the kings, because they were the ones who were making the weapons that the kings were using in their battle. So, you know, these, like in Italy, the famous Beretta, the famous gun, they started off making crossbows. It's been a family industry for something like 700 years. They started making crossbows for the king's army. Very powerful. You know, these are real string pullers of the world today. Krupp Industries, Herr Krupp, who founded this industry, he used to laugh at the Franco-Prussian War. He used to laugh, and he said, they were both sides, the Germans and the French, were using my bullets. So, chuckle and pat on his big fat belly. So, the capitalists then, but all of that's like a later manifestation in Europe of what already had happened in India thousands of years before. And Bhaktivinoda Thakur points out that then the Jain religion was the Vaishya rebellion against the one, because the Brahmins weren't giving any knowledge of moksha. All they were doing was performing sacrifices, doing rituals, arguing petty points of, you know, less important philosophies, filling their bellies, getting the big, fat, famous Brahmin bellies, and not teaching what we see in the Bhagavatam. Narada Muni is coming to teach the kings again and again, Maharaj Yudhisthira, Maharaj Prachini Barhi. He's coming to teach these great kings of old about moksha, about liberation, about the ultimate stage of life. But the Kali Yuga Brahmins, and actually it's always a result of that Sringi cursing a king who was spiritually more advanced than he was. So the Brahmins lost their power to preach moksha dharma. And so the Kshatriyas and the Vaishyas got sick of these people. And so then Buddha, Avatara Vishnu, came and established Buddhism. And it became the state religion of India. It was actually the state religion because of Maharaj Ashok, a king. And there's a famous story, you know, because this is in the Buddhist histories. They say within 100 days of Buddha's departure, there was already schism started to appear between the Buddhists about what he actually taught. Within 100 days, the Buddhist religion began to break up into different sects. And this went on for several centuries, and it was, but they still had potency because it was Lord Buddhadev's movement. So something like the Christians, you know, Jesus Christ had real Shakti, so somehow Christianity is still a powerful religion even today. So Maharaj Ashok, he was impressed. He was ready to do some big animal sacrifice, he was doing an animal sacrifice, and then he wanted to do a human sacrifice too, sacrifice a few human beings just to make sure that he'd become the most powerful king. It's always good to throw a few human beings into the fire too. So one of the humans that were, you know, it's just like Judd Bharat, that story. They sent out some men who were running around looking for spaced out looking people to be sacrificed. And they saw a Buddhist monk. And he seemed to be out of this world. So they grabbed him and they brought him up, and he was going to be sacrificed. And he started preaching to Maharaj Ashok and, you know, warned him of all the sins that he's going to, you know, all that's going to happen to him in hell as a result of doing all this, whether humans or animals, but you have to suffer all this pain that you've given to these other living entities. So then Ashok, he stopped everything and he inquired, who are you? What is this teaching? Well, I'm a Buddhist. Who is the Buddha? He told him. And so then Ashok started collecting all the Buddhists, having them come and teach him. And then he himself started to notice these differences of opinions. So he brought all the leaders of these different sects and he sat them down and he said, I'm giving you, he gave them a certain amount of days to work it out. And to work out what Buddhism really is. And that this was the Kshetriya, this was his role. This is why Varnashram Dharma still has a place in this world today. Especially in ISKCON. I often think if we had a king who would call in the GBC and look, you guys meet and I want an answer from you in 24 hours or there's going to be some big trouble. Then things would go a lot more smoothly. And so the Buddhists made their presentation before the king and he listened. And that which impressed him the most, he said, all right, this I approve and all the rest of you get out of here. I don't want to see you again. You're not bona fide Buddhists. Just go. Either join with them or go. And so he settled up what Buddhism was. Of course, later on it split up even more. So there's so many Buddhist sects. But Buddhism was particularly appealing to the Kshatriyas because it was giving them a moksha dharma, some kind of, you know, but it was only to the level of their maybe pranamoy or manamoy platform, the mind. Buddhism doesn't really go beyond the platform of the mind. Just negation. Moralism, which is pranamoy, and then negation, which is manamoy. Not even vijnanamoy, because the Buddhists don't accept the soul. Vijnanamoy platform, you actually understand the soul.
Gaur mentions that the impersonalists can't get beyond the manamoy platform. Is it aparoksha? Because aparoksha means the Lord descends into it, so they don't accept the Lord, so they can't get beyond aparoksha, just the experience.
So that means they cannot be called transcendentalists.
So they can't be called transcendentalists. Prabhupada categorizes them as transcendentalists, but they're not permanent, so they're not.
Yeah, well, there's also a difference between Mayavadi and Brahmavadi.
Yeah.
Brahmavadis are not envious of the Lord, they just happen to be coming. Following, there's that, because Krishna talks about these two paths in the Gita. He talks about the, like Prabhupada would say, the staircase and the elevator. Bhakti is the elevator. Mm-hmm. Just surrender to me. And the staircase, the Lord also describes these different yoga systems and Bahunam Gyanmananante Gyanavamam Prapadyante, after many, many births, one finds Vasudeva Savamiti, which is seeing Paramatma, Vasudeva everywhere. And that takes a long time, but that's those who follow that. That was the Vedic process, a slow Vedic process of self and God realization. They are not envious of the Lord, but the Mayavadis are actually envious of the Lord. They have a predisposition not to accept the personal form of the Lord, and so they just stop with negation, negating.
So they're actually basically
demons.
Yeah, demons.
They attain the same result as the demons. Whereas great, sincere Brahmavadis, like the four Kumaras, that's the example. They were actually Brahmavadis. They were actually Brahman realized. But they traveled through Brahman, and they one day the Lord let them. Although that Brahma Sangita Pantastu Koti Shatya Sampragamyo Vayuratapi Manaso Muni Pungavanam. One can travel in Brahman for millions and millions of years, but the Lord permitted them to come to the gate of Vaikuntha. That was by special permission of the Lord. Otherwise, they would have just been lost in the Jyoti. And it's also described in Brahma Samhita that Lord Shiva has these trisuls, these tridents that are made out of Brahman energy. And they're facing outward all around Goloka Vrindavan. And any Mayavadi who does happen to get too close, then he gets caught on these tridents and stuck there. He just hangs there like a fly buzzing. He can't enter the pastimes of the Lord because Lord Shiva, that's why Mahadev protects even in Bama Vrindavan. They have these 12 temples of Lord Shiva. He's the protector of his dharma.
Sadashi lives in the Brahman.
Yeah.
So that's
yeah.
That's what he does there. Right?
Yeah. He protects the Lord's pastimes.
That's why I told Gop Kumar in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita this, because Gop Kumar showed up at Sadashiva Loka and he didn't know what was going on. Sometimes he felt himself one with the Lord, sometimes he felt himself separate from the Lord, sometimes in between that, you know, all these different, you know, beta, dvaita, you know, all these different, he was experiencing them one after the other. And Lord Shiva appeared and said, this place is not for you, you're a devotee. You go on. He let him go. It's just the speculators and the impersonals who stay here. They're attracted to be here because they're, you know, there's so many esoteric things they can get into. Crystals and everything's there.
Tarot card.
Pyramids. Where do you think it all comes from? Okay, we have to. Shall we? Can I proceed?
Yeah.
We should really try to finish today because next week is yours. Next week belongs to the class. There's 4 days of presentation by the four panels. And we're going to be the ones watching and asking questions. You're going to see what it's like. So, 9.2, philosophical summary of chapter 9. This is a summary of important Bhaktivedanta purports from that chapter. 1, Krishna arranges pastimes in the material world to glorify his devotees. That's in purports 1 through 10. Devotees ungrudgingly accept the adverse conditions and sufferings they undergo in their devotional service, for they are committed to the Lord's plan, the exact nature of which no one can ascertain. 11 to 17, that's really important. I remember Prabhupada used to sometimes warn his devotees when they get carried away with their own plans of what Prabhupada would say, well, you have your plan and I have my plan, but Krishna has his plan. And so it's Krishna's plan that triumphs always. So that we have to become, we can have our plan in Krishna's service, of course. We should use our, that's what Krishna says, tad buddhyas, tad atmanas, tad nishtas, tad pranayana, in the 5th chapter. He asks us to use our buddhi and our intelligence and our minds. But he also says, put all your faith in me and make me your refuge. You see? It's like two sides of the story. Yes, use your mind and intelligence in my service, but at the same time, put all your faith in me and make me your only refuge, because your plans might not work out. But I'll still be there if you take shelter of me and will protect you. So, that's very important. Krishna reestablishes the conditioned soul's relationship with him by demonstrating pastimes with his pure devotees. Yeah, that's the same point with Bhishmadev. This is the same observation. What Bhishmadev was doing was setting an example for other kings who were used to this yoga practice that was established at that time for them. We see also even Dhritarashtra resorting to that. And even he got moksha, he got liberation, although he had done so many terrible things against the Lord and his devotees, conspiracies and so on. But even he got liberation by this process. So a great devotee like a Mahajan, like Bhishma, doesn't have to do this, but he's also setting an example. So Krishna reestablishes the conditioned soul's relationship with him by demonstrating pastimes with his pure devotees. His pastimes, regardless of the Lord's dealings, all produce ecstasy for his devotees. For the Lord, although internally guiding all living entities as super soul, even externally guides his devotees. So this is very mysterious. This is the thing, like that question a few days ago, why did Kunti Devi and the Pandavas have to suffer so much? And Prabhupada says, that Lord Jesus Christ, that whole pastime of him being put on the cross, well, sometimes Prabhupada said it actually didn't happen. It was a kind of illusion. But other times he would say this was ecstasy. And he certainly said that about Haridas Thakur being whipped in 22 or 27, I forgot, marketplaces. That this was actually ecstasy, and we can't understand that. And Bharat Maharaj is falling down and taking the body of a deer in that early part of the fifth canto. There's a purport where Prabhupada writes, there's two reasons why a Vaishnava may fall down. And one is due to Vaishnava Parad, and the other is due to the will of the Lord. And the Lord can be trying to teach the rest of us something by even causing his devotee to fall down. So what we see in the case of Bharat Maharaj is that even he did his devotional service was not interrupted, even though he was in the body of a deer. He kept going to get satsang and hear about Krishna, even in the body of a deer. So who is telling me? I was recently having a talk. I think it was Burijan Prabhu. He said, therefore, in one of the commentaries of the Acharyas to that section, Jiva Goswami points out that, because the question will be raised that if he was such, as Bharat Maharaj, such a already in the Bhava platform, he should have got Krishna. He was already in the Bhava platform, Bhava Bhakti platform. That means liberated. Bhava Bhakti is a liberated platform of devotional service. So he should have gotten Krishna. Why did he get the body of the deer? And Jiva Goswami comments that by getting the body of a deer, he got Krishna. But we cannot understand that, you see. So just leave it. But by getting the body of a deer, he got Krishna, and that's why in his next life he returned as Jad Bharat, and he was a great, although appearing like a deaf, dumb, blind idiot, practically. He was preaching to Maharaj Rahugana, who was a great, powerful king, and who became his disciple. So this is simply transcendental. You cannot understand it with the logic of the material world. Four pure devotees always think of Krishna as the greatest of yogis, and although such devotees are brought by Krishna to the spiritual sky after leaving their body, their only desire is to always think about Krishna, and the Lord in reciprocation arranges their glorification. In the pastime, the Lord arranged with Bhishma Dev, we learn that which attracts the mind of a dying man becomes the beginning of his next life. So one should always think of Krishna, and then, when he leaves his body, go back to Godhead, having faith that the Lord, who is also the Supreme Controller, will personally fulfill any spiritual desire one may have. Therefore, one should rid himself of all material desires, focus his mind on Krishna, and following Krishna's instructions, obtain a relationship with Krishna in the spiritual world. These are points made from purports 26 through 33. So intimate is the loving reciprocation between the devotees and the Lord that although a devotee is sometimes placed to act as the Lord's enemy within a particular pastime, nonetheless, the Lord accepts whatever his devotee offers because it is offered with love. The Lord becomes so obliged to his pure devotee that he desires to execute his devotee's orders as a father is pleased to execute the orders of his son. Sometimes the Lord puts his devotees in ignorance, as he did to Arjuna, so that the Bhagavad Gita could be spoken. Thus the devotee can carry on many relationships with the Lord, even by playing the part of an enemy, if that part is offered with transcendental love, 34 through 38. Dying while looking at or remembering Krishna carries one to the highest perfection of life, and one should therefore have the Lord before him when he dies, or hear the Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam, and thus pass at death to Vaikuntha to act either as the Lord's servant, friend, parent, or fiancé, 39 to 42. After a great devotee passes from this world and his spiritually surcharged body is offered special respect, the devotees feel separation for the great soul, not for the body, and then feel the Lord within themselves, within their hearts, as they glorify him and do their duty of consoling his His means the devotees, relatives, 43 through 49. So maybe you could talk about that, the funeral. That's the last point, because Prabhupada's actually referring to the funeral observations of departing Vaishnavas.
Means,
you know, in other words, in the material world, there's also funerals and relatives gather. Yeah. And
because it's like they're known to that person, just as the conditioned soul thinks they're their body, they also then think everybody else is their body. So for the spiritual persons, then they will connect with that more. They will see that the most. Even though the body, in this case, will be transcendental. So then the funeral rite will be for those who remember him. They are connected here with the soul. They are feeling that separation, and then the body reminds them of those pastimes and whatever was performed, because in one sense, being spiritualized is non-different. But for the others, then it becomes a focal point of actually that is the form of emotion and exchange and pastime is the form. So then both ways that it overlaps, so both can deal with it. There's not a problem for the advanced devotee to deal with a you know, funeral ceremony, or for anybody else. Everybody else, it's natural. And for the advanced devotee, it's the soul, and this is the, you know, the it's like, what do you call it? Vibhava. And within Vibhava, there's that, what reminds you? Udipan. So Udipan, so the devotee's body is the Udipan for the pastimes in exchange of spiritual activities that have been done with that devotee or by that devotee. Others, then even though it is Udipan, is more to them, it's more the body is the item. You know, so both are happy. Is that?
Well, also, if a servant or a disciple is present, or a family member of such a great Vaishnava, is the duty of them to make the bodies properly disposed. Just like Bhaktisiddhanta did to his guru, even though they wanted to drag him because it was his desire, mm-hmm. He makes it properly.
He says proper respect is given. Because it's their body is a holy place, because they perform so many spiritual activities. So then it's out of respect to the holy place that it's being done. You know, like the Lord comes and performs his pastimes in the Dham, so the Dham is special. You know, or the temple is special because the Lord resides in it. So in the same way as the body, the great devotees is special because they live there and perform their activities there. So naturally that respect.
So we can move on. Chapter 10. So this is the chapter after which we take a break next week for reviewing, with the help of these panels we've formed, reviewing particularly the important verses of the first 10 chapters of this canto. So chapter 10 is called The Departure of Lord Krishna for Dwarka. And this is a summary of the verses, the storyline. Samyaka questions Sutta about Yudhisthira's rule of the kingdom after the Kurukshetra battle. Yes, in this chapter there's one question, one of the Bhagavatam questions that we're concerned with in this course. This question number 15. So this question is being mentioned. We'll go into detail shortly. Samyaka questions Yudhisthira about Yudhisthira's rule of the kingdom after the Kurukshetra battle. And Sutta Goswami answers by describing the wonderful world situation created by Yudhisthira's reign. Sukadev then narrates Krishna's departure from Hastinapur to Dwarka and describes the expressions of affection by the residents of Hastinapur, especially the ladies of Hastinapur, who offer their prayers as the Lord leaves. These are verses 1 through 6 and 7 through 20, summarized. The ladies appreciate their fortune in seeing the Lord and creator of the universe, Krishna, who is usually only seen by great pure devotees and who mercifully descends to the material world in different ages. Verses 21 through 25. The ladies then describe the glories of the land in which Krishna descends, as well as the great fortune of the wives of Krishna, who so intimately relate with him. 26 through 30. The Lord accepts the prayers of the ladies and leaves Hastinapur for Dwarka. 31 through 36. So now, question 15 of Srimad Bhagavatam is asked by Shaunaka Rishi to Suta Goswami. And that question is, after killing his enemies who desired to usurp his rightful inheritance, how did the greatest of all religious men, Maharaj Yudhisthira, assisted by his brothers, rule his subjects? Surely he could not freely enjoy his kingdom with unrestricted consciousness. So Prabhupada, in the purport to verse 1, points out the philosophical significance of this question. That, quoting Prabhupada, the inquiry was important for Shaunaka Rishi, who wanted to know about the behavior of Maharaj Yudhisthira when he was at ease to enjoy the kingdom. Because these sages were, of course, already familiar with the Mahabharata, the whole story of the Pandavas. And we see there how righteous, good, and soft-hearted Yudhisthira was, although he was a Kshatriya. But he's actually Dharma personified, his incarnation of Dharma. So I always think, when I think of Yudhisthira, I always think of when Karna wanted to demonstrate in one day his superiority over all the five Pandavas. So he attacked each one. And he fought. There was a fierce fight between him and Maharaj Yudhisthira, but Karna wore Maharaj Yudhisthira down and could have given him the killing blow. But then Karna stopped. And he said, I will not kill you, because actually you're not really a Kshatriya, you're a Brahmana. And kill it, that would be Brahmahatya, that would be a great sin. So therefore he just turned to the Kauravas and said, see, I've defeated him. And they all applauded, they were all fired up. I fought him to a standstill, but I will not kill him, because he's actually a Brahmana. So the sages, they knew all about Maharaj Yudhisthira, so therefore Shaunaka, he brought up this question, how would such a personality as Yudhisthira be able to enjoy his kingdom, built on the carcasses of so many millions of soldiers and animals and wailing women on the battlefield, cradling their husbands' heads to their breasts and crying, and this whole scene of misery. So Suta Goswami gives his principal answer to question 15 in verse 2. And that answer is, Lord Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead, who is the maintainer of the world, became pleased after reestablishing Maharaj Yudhisthira in his own kingdom and after restoring the Kuru dynasty, which had been exhausted by the bamboo fire of anger. So that's the main point, that as we shall see, Yudhisthira was very, very, that will be coming shortly, he was very, very perturbed at what he had to go through to win the battle. And he didn't want to take up the throne. All this horror of war, so many persons killed, so much bloodshed. He felt very, very bad, but ultimately, because it was Krishna's will, once he understood that, and the other Pandavas understood that this is what Krishna wants, this is Krishna's implacable desire. It was the same thing with Arjuna. It's because you don't want to fight that I want you to fight, because that was actually Arjuna's qualification, because then you can fight for me. Because you yourself don't want to fight. Good. But I want you to fight. So now don't fight for yourself, and you won't be in that anxiety. Because you see no reason to fight. All right. But I'm giving you a reason to fight. Fight for me. And this is the same with the Yudhisthira ascending the throne. And the philosophical significance of this answer is given by Srila Prabhupada in the purport to verse 2. The Prabhupada writes, in the material world, the wrath of those who want to lord it over material nature interacts, and the fire of war takes place, exhausting the unwanted population. Such fires of war take place, and the Lord has nothing to do with them. But because, I remember getting into an argument about this, not an argument really, but there was a kind of a discussion. I gave a lecture in Helsinki, Finland, and there were a lot of, this was not so long, so many years ago, and so a lot of Russians have come to Finland, which is next door to their country, and there were some Russians attending, and someone was asking a question. I think an Indian gentleman was asking a question. He was comparing the Battle of Kurukshetra to the Second World War, a Yuddha Dharma, a war of righteousness. And I said, the Second World War, you cannot compare to the Battle of Kurukshetra. And then some of the Russians, they got very upset. Because, but that was the great patriotic war. We saved our country. This is, but Prabhupada clearly says here, the fire, such materialistic wars, this is the interaction of the modes of nature, and the Lord has nothing to do with them. It's just that whoever wins rewrites history and makes themselves the hero. And, you know, our side was the good side. You see, if Hitler had won the war, then we'd all be reading in the German language textbooks that the National Socialist cause was the right cause and triumphed over the degraded capitalists and communists. That's the way the world is. But because he wants to maintain the creation, he desires the mass of people to follow the right path of self-realization, which enables the living entities to enter into the kingdom of God. The Lord wants the suffering human beings to come back home, back to Him, and cease to suffer the threefold material pangs. The whole plan of creation is made in that way, and one who does not come to his senses suffers in the material world by pangs inflicted by the illusory energy of the Lord. The Lord therefore wants His bona fide representative to rule the world. Lord Sri Krishna descended to establish the sword of regime, and to kill the unwanted persons who have nothing to do with his plan. The battle of Kurukshetra was fought according to the plan of the Lord, so that undesirable persons could get out of the world. That's Prabhupada's own words. So that undesirable persons could get out of the world, and a peaceful kingdom under his devotee could be established. The Lord was therefore fully satisfied when King Yudhisthira was on the throne, and the seedling of the dynasty of Kuru in the person of Maharaj Parikshit was saved. Part 10.6 of the study guide, in verses 3 to 7, Sutta Goswami adds details to this principal answer. There was a principal answer that this was the Lord's will. And then these are some symptomatic results of the Lord's being satisfied. The Lord was so satisfied with Maharaj Yudhisthira's rule of the world, that, point one, Maharaj Yudhisthira, after being enlightened by what was spoken by Bhishma Dev and Lord Sri Krishna, the infallible, engaged himself in matters of perfect knowledge because all his misgivings were eradicated. Thus he ruled over the world, the earth and seas, and was followed by his younger brothers. During the reign of Maharaj Yudhisthira, the cloud showered all the water that people needed. The earth produced all the necessities of man in profusion. Due to its fatty milk bag and cheerful attitude, the cow used to moisten the grazing ground with milk. The rivers, oceans, hills, mountains, forests, creepers, and active drugs in every season paid their tax quota to the king in profusion. That means the hills themselves opened up mines, and you can just imagine diamonds and rupees and rubies and sapphires and emeralds just came spilling out. This is what we owe you, king. That's how material nature, this is the Daivi Vidya. There's Asura Vidya, or Yantra Vidya, where we dig big holes in the ground to pull out the minerals and the oil. And Prabhupada explained this is how the earth happened to wobble out of its orbit and fall into the ocean, because that was Hiranyaksha's program. He was squeezing the earth of all of its goodness to fill his and his brother's coffers. And so Bhumi protested and fell into the ocean. So the same thing is going now. This is called the Asuric Vidya, the knowledge of the Asuras, their science. And this is the Daivi Vidya, the divine science of the real Varna Ashram, Daivi Varna Ashram Dharma. Then nature is, which is the energy of the Lord, is willfully reciprocating with the devotees. Then the population, Bhumi is of course burdened by population, but this becomes a burden of love, like mother carrying child. She never thinks, this child is too heavy, let me throw it down. She never thinks like that. She's always satisfied to carry the child. So because of the kings having no enemy, the living entities, the living beings were not at any time disturbed by mental agonies, diseases, or excessive heat or cold. Sri Hari, Lord Sri Krishna, resided at Hastinapur for a few months to pacify his relatives and please his own sister Subhadra. And the last point is interesting. We can finish up here. That the Bhagavatam's first introduction of emotions of pure devotional love in the conjugal rasa is in Canto 1, Chapter 10. Specifically, in bidding farewell to the Lord, the ladies of Hastinapur say amongst themselves, "Oh, how supremely glorified is the dynasty of King Yadu, and how virtuous is the land of Mathura, where the supreme leader of all living beings, the husband of the goddess of fortune, has taken his birth and wandered in his childhood. Oh, friends, just think of his wives, whose hands he has accepted. How they must have undergone vows, baths, fire sacrifices, and perfect worship of the Lord of the universe, to constantly relish now the nectar from his lips by kissing. Damsels of Rajabhumi would often faint just by expecting such favors." This is verses 26 and 28. According to Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur in the Sri Bhagavat Arka Marichimala, chapter 18, these verses express prema mahima, the glory of rasa, which is attained by pure love of Godhead. So the Bhagavatam is, this is the Udaya, this is the dawning of the Bhagavatam in the first canto, but already the very brilliant rays of the conjugal rasa are peeking over the horizon. Like sometimes you see, the sunrise can be very glorious and they're very brilliant rays of very beautiful colors, and they stream out from behind the earth and they fill the sky, pierce through the clouds. So it's like that, very beautiful. That we're getting a hint of what is the full splendor of the Krishna sun, the conjugal pastimes, which will be displayed in the 10th canto. We're getting just a little taste of that now. So remarkably, we have 6 minutes and nothing to do except answer your sincere questions. And oh, the question machine already has his answer up. But is there anyone else who might have a question? Yes, Prabhu.
When we were saying that this chivalrous nature of Bhishma, that he wanted to fight with Lord Krishna, in the Sakya Rasa, this fighting going on with Krishna, but this is a servitude fight. Yes. Because he don't go beyond the Sakya.
Well, here I would caution you. What I was trying to say when I was talking about Bhishma before, in saying that how he appeared to be externally one of these mumuksha bhavas, a person seeking liberation, and that's why he used the yoga process, but actually he's not really. So really we cannot estimate his position. We just know that in this chivalrous lila of the Lord, this is the role he takes. You see, in the spiritual world, we find that just as the original Krishna, Svayam Rupa Krishna, expands, And his Shakti, the Adya Shakti Srimati Rani, similarly expands with him. And so she becomes in Ayodhya Sita, in Vaikuntha she becomes Mahalakshmi. And then as we approach Shishti Stiti Pralaya Lila, then she becomes Rama Devi. So she's expanding along with the Lord. So similarly, the Lord's devotees expand also. And so Narada Muni, whom we know as a Vaikuntavasi, he also dwells in Goloka Vrindavan as the Brahmana Madhumangal. It's the same person. But he's so attached to the Lord that just as the Lord is expanding, he is also expanding. You see? And even comes into the material world. And so it's revealed in the Goswami Granta that Arjuna has a gopi form, a runi gopi. Arjuna of the battlefield of Kurukshetra has a gopi form. So, you know, we shouldn't just come to these cut and dried conclusions, you know, when we're reading something like this, which is describing a specific aspect of the Lord's pastime, the chivalrous, that's the Lord in his chivalrous mood, driving the chariot. But that's not all that Krishna does. And Krishna's parshadas, his nitya parshadas, they're always with him. And they're so Krishna conscious, they're there because they want to see Krishna in all his, that's particularly Narada Muni. He's so curious about what Krishna is doing, so he follows, he's always there. Every avatar that comes down, he shows up. What are you doing, my Lord? Oh, now you're in the form of a boar. That's so wonderful. Yeah, he visits every one of them. He's so curious, you know. And that's why it's sometimes said, sometimes you read that Narada is a, he's a, sometimes it's said he's a Jnana Mishra Bhakta. You know, and then devotees think, oh, that must mean he's not very elevated. But it just means he's just so very curious to see the Lord's all these. I mean, if I could be that kind of Jnana Mishra Bhakta, I would be. That would be a wonderful day. That would be the success of our lifetime, you know, if we could become that kind of Mishra Bhakta. You know, because he's seeing all of the Lord's pastimes simultaneously from Goloka all the way down to Sheshnag at the bottom of this universe. He's also going there and having discussions, philosophical discussions with Sheshnaga.
Yeah, Hanuman go there and they dance.
Yes, David, you haven't asked a question for a long time.
Bhishma mentioned that the super soul is one, and he gives the example of the sun being one for every individual. But how literal is that analogy? Is the super soul one in the sense of the sun is to us, or is the super soul expanded separately but same equality among all beings?
Well, it's a chincha beda abeda tattva, and I think the fact of this, that example of the sun is very appropriate because the sun remains one. Yet Prabhupada would say that he would sometimes give the example of a transatlantic phone call. So someone from Los Angeles might be phoning a friend in London, and they're having a talk, and a friend in London says, oh, it's midnight here. And the man in Los Angeles says, well, here it's noon. The sun's out. It's beautiful. I'm in L.A., man. And then the next morning, the sun will rise in London, you know, coming up from the other side. But it's the same sun, you see. But one person is thinking the sun's not here, and the other says, "Yeah, the sun's here now." But the sun is actually always shining on the earth throughout 24 hours. It's the earth, part of the earth turns away from the sun. You see, it's we who are turned away, and therefore we think the Lord comes and goes, or the Lord is here and not there.
The example also the pots. So many pots that one sun's reflected
in. Yeah, reflected in all the pots. There you actually see it. One sun, but many reflections. So that's the greatness of the sun. So Krishna is so great. You see? Think of Mahavishnu. He's the first Purusha manifestation. So because these three Purushas are, it's explained, they're actually not different from one another. They're one and the same, actually. And that's why it's actually said, when we sleep at night, that experience we have of dreamless sleep in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad is the experience of the soul returning to Mahavishnu and going back into, merging into his body in that original Susupti state. When we actually do that every night. We merge into, it said we merge into the local Paramatma, but he's not different from Mahavishnu. So then just think of, you know, Mahavishnu. How can you think of Mahavishnu? He's so fantastically huge. He's just beyond all incredible imagination. And that same Lord is in our heart, you see. And therefore that, in Brahma Sanghita, the same thing, that, what is that? Adantara Paramana Chayantarastam Govindamari Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. That all the universes are somewhere within the body of the Lord, and yet simultaneously he's within every atom in every one of those universes, the same Lord Govinda. So it just boggles the mind, because it means the same Lord Govinda in every atom has those universes in his body too. So, you know, you have to just leave aside all your academic, you know, logic and all of that, you know, just put it in the shelf and slam it shut, because it doesn't work on this level.
Plus, it's a matter of space. The brain can only handle so much. Yeah. It's like this big. So you have to stick the whole universe inside there.
Okay.
Just one on the thing of the chivalry. Also, you have the element of jai bijai. Because the Lord likes to chase the fighting rasa, so their service is to come and act as those who fight with him. So then the chivalry can be an element of service. So that all the elements of the rasa can be tasted by everyone, but they have their place and how it's done. You know, like even in the conjugal, you have the chivalrous, because it's very common that the boys and girls will always make comments to show each one is superior, but it's only done to create intimacy.
Yeah.
You know? So it's they pervade through all.
Because sometimes it's minimized the position of Bhishma, that he died because so many reactions, so many arrows, or that because he ate the grains of Duryodhana, he was bleeding out. So that, like, if we'll be an ordinary human being who raised to some higher position, but actually he's so great that he's just sporting.
Yeah, he's doing that. He just says those things because from the devotee side of view, they always see that I'm fallen and this and that. So other kings, why would they serve under Duryodhana? He's doing it because it's the Lord's desire. Because otherwise, if Duryodhana didn't have Bhishma, Karna, and Shakuni and all those persons, how could he consider even challenging the Pandavas? So to have the Kurukshetra war, you have to have Bhishma and all those people stay there. So he is making his point on the material point of niti. Don't, you know, accept the support of a materialist, because it will affect you. It won't affect him, but, you know, that's his point. So we on the material platform learn from that for ourselves, and he gives that as excuses the devotee will always find. You see, Priya Bhagavatam Rita, the devotees take the same glorification and turn it around as their own fault. You know, so that's just the nature of the devotee. You know, as Maharaj mentioned, it's transcendental.
You know, it's something you can think of also. Srila Prabhupada has been said by one of our god brothers while riding in a taxi, I think, to here to Mayapur, commenting. They were talking about Varnashram Dharma, and Prabhupada made this remark. Only 50% of my work is done, because the next part would be to establish Varnashram Dharma, which Prabhupada was seeing more and more need for. So, but is that a fault of Srila Prabhupada? No one, I think, in their right mind would ever dare think, well, Prabhupada only did half of what he was supposed to do. So. And actually, someone asked Srila Prabhupada, if Bhaktivinoda Thakur, at the time he appeared, if he was a pure devotee on the earth and he was so qualified, why didn't he spread Krishna consciousness all over the world? And then Prabhupada said, he left it for me to do. You see, that's also the mercy of the Vaishnava, that he distributes service to others who are qualified. So, yeah. Very deep, these things. Not to be summed up in some foolish way by our little brains. Okay, I guess we have to stop. So please, everyone, come next week because we're going to have some entertaining presentations.
Do you have an essay or anything this week?
Oh yeah, we will not be giving any essay because the full-time and part-time members are going to be rehearsing and so on. I understand two of the four panels are going to be presenting dramas, if I haven't been misinformed, so that requires a lot of rehearsal and concentration. Memorizing lines and all that.
Shri Prabhupada ki
jai,
Samaveda Bhaktivedanta ki
jai,
Rajaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki
jai, Jai Jai Gaur.